The fifth aliyah of Parshas Toldos is incredibly dramatic and well-known, essentially the follow-up to the first aliyah, in which we read about Yaakov obtaining the birthright from Esav, but it's in this aliyah where he acts to obtain the brachos from Yitzchak that were meant to go to Esav, and he does so at the instruction of his mother Rivka, and he does so in a way that certainly seems to be deceptive, and that itself is the topic of much discussion in the Mefarshim. And there's already a little bit of a foreshadowing of it in the very beginning of the aliyah, where we're told that Esav's wives were a source of problems for his parents, and that it relates, as far as the Mefarshim tell us, to the fact that Yitzchak had become blind. Because the pasuk relates here in the beginning of Perek Chav Zayin that Vayhi Kizaken Yitzchak Vatikachena Inav Meraos. So his eyes became dim; it was hard for him to see. He became blind, and Chazal tell us a number of reasons why that happened. And among them, Rashi quotes the idea that these wives of Esav, who were involved in idolatry and avodah zarah, so the smoke of their offerings got in his eyes and caused him to go blind. So the Sifrei Chachamim explains that this impacted on Yitzchak, but not on Rivka, because Rivka was used to this avodah zarah from her upbringing, and that has an implication on the symbolic level as well, because her having been brought up in a very different household than Yitzchak was also impacts the rest of the story. And this is something that Rav Shlomo Miller, the Rosh Yeshiva from Toronto, commented upon. They recently published a sefer of his sichos, where he notes that her upbringing also contributed to the fact that she was able to catch on to Esav's trickery in a way that Yitzchak was not. And also, together with that, she understood how to outsmart him. And that was important. This is a part of what the pasuk tells us, a pasuk that appears both in Sefer Tehillim and in Shmuel Beis, via Mikesh Titapal, that when dealing with someone who is not completely straight, it's sometimes necessary even for an honest person to know how to outsmart him. And that's partially so that this individual shouldn't prevail with his trickery. So Rivka knew how to do that because of her background, and that was a sensitivity that Yitzchak didn't have. So just as Yitzchak became blinded by the smoke of the avodah zarah and Rivka had an immunity to that, she also had a perceptiveness that allowed her to appreciate what Esav was about and also how to outsmart him. But nonetheless, this process that she asks Yaakov to take on to deceive Yitzchak certainly seems difficult for us to understand, even if it was necessary for the future of Klal Yisrael and a result of Rivka's nevuah. And we do find attitudes in Chazal that tell us that there is a price that the Jewish people paid for this. So the Bereishis Rabba tells us that because Yaakov made Esav cry, so his descendants paid for this, and they cried because of this. So, for example, Chazal connect this to the pasuk in the beginning of the fourth parak of Megillas Esther, where we're told about Mordechai crying, and the Tanchuma tells us that Esav cried three tears, one from his right eye, and one from his left eye, and one that was held back, and that tear has salted our exile. So the notion that there's a price that came out of how Esav lost out to Yaakov in this manner specifically is a notion that appears in Chazal and appears in some of the Mefarshim as well, specifically Rav Shamshon Rafael Hirsch, who discusses how we can understand this while at the same time having somewhat of a critical approach to it. He notes that from Yaakov's perspective, so he felt that he had to listen to Rivka, who was his mother, but still he should have felt that there was some limit to how far he should go with this. But from Rivka's perspective, so how are we meant to understand what she was thinking? So here, if Yaakov is going to receive the brachos in such a way, how would they even be effective? Wouldn't it be a mekach tos if Yitzchak were to give him the brachos under false pretenses? And he suggests that actually the plan was more complicated, that this was Rivka's efforts to try to display to Yitzchak how he's been taken in by Esav. And therefore, she wanted to show Yitzchak just how easily he can be deceived. And therefore, she was orchestrating this whole show so that essentially Yitzchak should appreciate that it's possible for him to be fooled and that he would realize that the same thing had been going on with Esav. And there's much to say about the attitude that Yitzchak had to Esav, some of which we discussed in the first Aliyah. There are those who suggest that there was more of a complexity to Yitzchak's attitude towards Esav. We mentioned that the Rashiv Karen B'Yavna, Rav Goldwicht, and also the Mashgiach Rav Ivlin have similar approaches, that Yitzchak thought that Esav had the ability to bring together the Gashmias and the Ruchnias, while he understood that Yaakov was more of a Tamimistic person and more spiritual, and he thought that maybe it was necessary in order to move the mission forward to have a combination of Gashmias and Ruchnias. The Sforno already writes that he thought he could create a Shutfa similar to what would be with Yisachar and Zvulun. Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky understood that the whole mission of the Avos is to be Mekadesh Shem Shamayim in this world specifically, and that Yaakov thought maybe Yaakov was too parish, Yitzchak thought about him. Rav Kook has an approach which is one that's also particularly resonant for us today, that maybe it would be necessary for the Jews to be able to overcome their enemies, to have the ability to fight and to hunt like Esav had, and therefore perceiving that ability in him was a part of his belief that this was necessary in order to protect the Jewish people, and that Yaakov, as spiritual as he was, he wouldn't have the kelim to be able to defend the Jewish people. Maybe for that reason he thought he had to give the brachos to Esav. So there are many suggestions among the earlier and later Mefarshim about why it is that Yitzchak thought that perhaps even if it was indeed understood to him that Yaakov was certainly more spiritual and more refined, that nonetheless there was a need to give these brachos specifically to Esav. Rav Hirsch discusses why it is that Yitzchak asks specifically for a meal in the context of these brachos. What does that have to do with anything? And he suggests that along similar lines, he wanted to display to Esav how he could take his hunting skill and convert it to something more ruchni. So that whole combination was meant to be integrated into this process of the brachos. Schwab noted that Yitzchak's appreciation for Esau's food was contributed to by the fact that he felt a ruchnius in tasting the food. And he suggests that the ruchnius actually came from the mitzvah that Esav had. He did have this mitzvah of kibarav, and that actually conferred a certain spirituality into his food, and that was what Yitzchak was perceiving. And Rivka was trying to harness that same schus and give that to Yaakov, and that's why specifically she commands Yaakov to do this whole mission as an act of respect to her. It's interesting, actually, this whole notion of Esav's kibarav aim. So we find that Yitzchak commands Esav to go and to get an animal for him. And Rashi explains that it specifically should be min hefker and that he shouldn't steal the animal. So what's the idea here all of a sudden that he's worried that he might steal it? So it could be that this is similar to what we'll learn later. Chazal will tell us about Esav's son Eliphaz, that somebody who's confused, who has somewhat of what Reb Chaim Shalevitz and Hesichos would describe as a mixture of light and darkness. So you think that you are acting in a positive way by respecting your parents and also following instructions to kill your Rebbe. That's what Eliphaz did. So here maybe Esav would think, okay, my father wants a meal, so I'll respect him by stealing an animal, because you have that mixture of good and bad, and you don't know how to make good decisions. Rav Nosson Gishtetner in his Sefer Lahoris Nosson, here Al HaTorah, has a whole discussion of what kind of a cheshbon he could have made, that maybe Kibbut Av Aim would have influenced him to think that he could steal an animal in order to provide him with a good meal to follow his instructions. So this idea that maybe Esav would have been confused in his morality in such a way, so Yitzchak was appreciative that there was that mixture of forces within him, And he was trying to direct it and harness the good within him and to try to make something out of that. But he tells him to bring him this food and that I'll eat it and that will make me happy. And the Shut Maharam notes that when somebody gives a bracha, so he needs to be happy, which is an idea we find actually incorporated into halacha. So we know we have a mitzvah in HaTorah of Birchas Kohanim, but in Chutz La'aretz, so we only do it on Yontif. And it's a discussion why that is. And the Ramah suggests that maybe we need to have enough simcha, and only on Yontif do we have enough simcha. In Chutz La'aretz, we don't have enough simcha, so we can only wait till Yontif when we have enough simcha, because it's crucial in order to confer the bracha, we need to have simcha. So here we find that Yitzchak is saying, I need to be in a good mood in order to be able to give you the brachas. So okay, so he tells Esav that this is what the mission is going to entail. And Rivka has this whole plan that Yaakov is going to take his place. And she describes what he needs to do. And here we find that Yaakov is hesitant and he's worried. And he says, Ulai Musheni Avi, that maybe my father is going to feel the difference. He's going to recognize what's going on, and he's going to suspect me. And Chazal notes in conjunction with this, the Gemara Maseches Makos and Daf Chav Dalet, that Yaakov was lo ragal al shono, it's a pasuk in Tehillim, and that he was careful not to speak Lashon Hara. So how is that relevant to this? So the Torah Tamima explains that maybe when he's confronted with Yitzchak, who realizes that he's an imposter, so he's not going to want to speak Lashon Hara by Rivka and say that it was her fault and say that it was all her idea, so he's going to have to take all the blame. So that's why he's praised for not speaking Lashon Hara in connection specifically with this. And the Maharsha explains differently in his comments to Makos that because he was careful about Lashon Hara, he wasn't going to explain why Esav was not worthy of the brachos. He could have defended himself by saying that Esav is a character who does all kinds of terrible things, and therefore it was necessary for me to come in and take his place. But he's not going to want to say all that because he's careful about Lashon Hara, and therefore he's again going to allow himself to look bad and not going to say what needs to be said in order to defend himself. And a part of this conflicted attitude that he has, so the Vilna Gaon notes that there's a difference between the word pen and ulai, and that pen is what you say when you don't want something to happen. And here he says ulai. Ulai suggests actually that maybe he does want it to happen, that he wants to get caught, that his honesty is such that he kind of doesn't want to get away with this because he's worried about how this is going to affect him, that he should get the brachos in a dishonest way, and he almost wants to get caught. So this language of ulai has that connotation to it. And he's worried that if he's caught, so he will be perceived as kemisatea, as somebody who is deceptive. And the Gemara in Masechet Sanhedrin and Daf Tzadi Beis Amud Aleph notes that you find a similar language and say for Yirmiyahu in connection with Avodah Zarah. And the Gemara says that kol ha-machlif diburo, whoever switches around, changes his language, is compared to somebody who is an Oved Avodah Zarah. And that comparison is very striking, especially in this context. So there's a sefer called Chikrei Aaron, a contemporary sefer on a number of sugyas, where he suggests that the nature of this issur specifically is that a part of Avodah Zarah, which isn't really about genuine religion, it's also about trying to get people to give things to the source of worship. So that's what he's comparing here, that this is something I'm trying to obtain through my deception. So it's similar to Avodah Zarah. It's one way of understanding it. It's a type of Gnevas Das, really. It's a way of deception in order to acquire something, but in this case it would have been for a good cause, but nonetheless it would have had some similarity to it, and that's what the Gemara is comparing. The Torah Tamima has a different understanding. He's just noting that lying and deceiving, misleading, is corrosive, and just a little bit of it can lead to more. So if one can mislead about anything, so then that can come to misleading even about the nature of God and to actual Avodah Zarah. So here Rivka tells him to wear big de'esa. The Das Kanim explains that he had special hunting clothes that had pictures of animals, that looked real, and that he should wear them in order to look like Esav. And the Sefer Ebir Yaakov, he points out that that's a little strange, because if Yitzchak couldn't see anyway, so why was it so important that he should be dressed to look like Esav? So he suggests that this is reflective of the fact that clothes have a hashpa on how you act. So in a sense, perhaps this is a type of method acting. So it's the idea that the actors dress like the characters are trying to be, even in ways that the audience can't necessarily see, but it helps them to get into character. So maybe that's a part of it. He should dress like Esav. He'll have an easier time getting into character and having this successful impression on Yitzchak, so he should perceive him as Esav. And this idea of Hakol Kol Yaakov V'Hayidayim Yidei Esav, so there's a comment the Ramban has earlier, that apparently with all of this, we see that Yaakov wasn't afraid that he'd be identified by his voice. And you would think that they have different voices, and that should also be a tip-off. So how come he wasn't worried about that? So he has two interpretations, the Ramban. One is that perhaps they actually did have the same voice, that they were brothers who actually had similar voices. And this difference of Hakol Kol Yaakov that's being identified in the Pasuk is the way they spoke, their manner of speech, and their choice of words, and that Yaakov was refined in his speech and Esav was gruff and crude, and therefore that was something that he could control. He could choose to talk and to sound like Esav, and therefore he wasn't worried that he'd be identified by his voice, because it was more a matter of word choice. Alternatively, he suggests that maybe they did have different voices, but maybe Yaakov knew how to imitate him. He knew how to do a good Esav, and therefore he wasn't worried that Yitzchak would catch on because of that. But there is also the question of his language, and here we have this fascinating comment that Rashi makes, that when Yaakov says, Anochi Esav Becharecha, which certainly seems like the most overt act of deception here he's claiming to be Esav, which he is not. And Rashi tells us that there is a period in the middle, essentially, and what he's actually saying is, Anochi Hamevi Lecha, I'm the one bringing this, and Esav Becharecha, and Esav is your firstborn. So that's very difficult on the surface, because that doesn't really change anything as far as the deception. And if you're going to deal in business like this, or with your friends like this, or with your spouse like this, and you're going to just move around punctuation and say things that are misleading, but you're thinking in your mind that you have a different interpretation of the words, so that's not going to be any less misleading. It's not going to be any less dishonest. So what exactly was Yaakov accomplishing here? And this is something that the Rosh Yeshiva of Karabiyav and Rav Goldwicht discussed at length, and Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky discussed at length as well, and it's a very crucial point that here Yaakov understood that it was necessary, for whatever reason, to act in a deceptive manner in order to accomplish what was necessary for the moment. But at the same time, he still had to act to preserve his own Midas Emes, which of course was his defining characteristic, that he was a person of truth, and he had to make sure to hold on to that. So even if it was necessary to compromise for the needs of the moment, at the same time, he had to make sure that that wasn't going to have a hashpa on his soul. And he had to take steps to do whatever he could to preserve his internal honesty, even if at the same time it was still going to come across in a way to the listener in a deceptive fashion. And that is a crucial point about all such things, that even if there are times when it's necessary to compromise in order to accomplish some kind of crucial goal, to make sure that it doesn't have a corrosive effect on your midos is very crucial. And that's why it's also a little bit of a pella. There are those who suggest that when it comes to Pesach night, so many have a practice to have the afikomen hidden and the children look for it. And there's among those menhagim, there is a practice that many have that the children steal the afikomen. And there were many who objected to that because it seems like something that could train one in bad midos, especially as the Rambam paskins based on the Gemara, that even to steal something temporarily is a problem, because the Rambam's understanding is it trains you in the midah of stealing, could be possibly an issur d'oraisa. So there were those who were opposed to this minhag, or Shlomo Zalman was opposed to calling it stealing at least. He thought that that was something that was dangerous. So there's a surprising defense that some suggest that maybe the reason that practice developed is because this story of the brachos took place. It was Pesach night, and Yitzchak was eating the Afikomen, and because that was the case, the Afikomen was involved, and Yaakov had to act in a way that involved trickery, so therefore we commemorate his trickery in conjunction with the Afikomen. And that seems like a very surprising interpretation, because really what we find here is that Yaakov worked very hard to make sure that the trickery shouldn't stick to him, it shouldn't have an effect on his soul, and that's what he's doing here. He's trying to preserve his internal integrity, even while there is this very temporary need to dip into trickery. And that's what the pasuk says in Tehillim, that's invoked in conjunction with him, it's Tzila Nafshi Misfas Sheker, that my nefesh, my neshama, should be saved from the impact of Sheker, that he davened, that his children shouldn't be impacted by this, that this shouldn't pass on to the future generations. So the idea that we would honor that aspect of what he did certainly seems very much contrary to the whole idea that here he doesn't want this to last, he doesn't want the trickery to have a impact that is going to endure in his nisham and pass on to future generations. And that's his whole avoda here specifically, that this is something that he's very careful to avoid. And perhaps that's also a part of his godless here, that we know that Yaakov is the Isha Emes, and this is something that he's so careful to preserve and to hold up as a value. And yet, he also not only is willing to do what's necessary, but he's willing to allow himself to be perceived in this situation as somebody who's less than truthful, while at the same time knowing that he's still going to work to preserve his own internal integrity. And that's a very powerful message. And that's very relevant also for the descendants that bear his name, the Bnei Yisrael, that right now, and as has so often been the case, that the world does not appreciate just how hard they work to preserve their midos and their character and their conduct in war and the extraordinary efforts that the Jewish army takes in order to protect life and to act with sensitivity, and the world doesn't recognize it or appreciate it and makes accusations and allegations that are completely the opposite. But at least the Jews themselves, they know what steps they take and what efforts they take to protect their souls and to make sure that their neshamos are as pure as possible. And this is a tremendous midah that is inherited from the original Yisrael, from Yaakov Avinu, and just like he davened, it should continue to be a protection for his neshama and for the neshamos of all of his descendants.